In April of 1778, the American Revolution, not even yet at its halfway point, was raging. And in Georgia, Patriot Colonel Samuel Elbert, the son of a Baptist minister, had caught wind of something. The British Navy, the most powerful and dominant fleet in the world, had ships located just off St. Simon's Island, and they were sniffing around for a fight. And Elbert, with very little naval command experience, wouldn't stand for it. So on April 18th, he dispatched the Georgia Navy, a group of three row galleys, to the waters off St. Simon's to see what was going on and to mount a defense. And if this did become a fight, those small row galleys, often fragile and powered by oars alone, would be defending against the hulking vessels of the British Royal Navy. What unfolded across the next 24 hours wouldn't go down in the history books as a major battle in the Revolution's Southern Theater. But by the time the conflict was over, it would be one of the most galvanizing events for the Patriots in Georgia, and a defining moment in the life and leadership of Colonel Elbert, who would go on to become Georgia governor. And that whole conflict, the fight that the British Navy had been picking, known as the Frederica Naval Action, would leave the British Navy scratching their heads, wondering why and how this all went sideways. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked the Podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting, where we're exploring Georgia and the people, places, and moments that tell the bigger story of our state. And the marker we're talking about on today's episode is on a leafy road on St. Simon's Island, marking the story of the Georgia Navy. And if you're like me, you probably don't connect revolutionary Georgia with naval warfare. But yes, that in fact is something that happened here back in April of 1778 during what is known as the Frederica Naval Action. And we wanted to use the Georgian Navy as a jumping off point to talk about not only what happened off St. Simon's Island, but the larger picture of the revolution on the water. And joining us today to go through that is our first guest, who is no stranger to Marked, the video series, or the podcast. He's a professor of history at the University of North Georgia and author of a book about Samuel Elbert, one of the stars of this particular story, Dr. Clay Utz. Clay, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Our other guest is a lecturer in history and core cultures at Hampton-Sydney College, and her research sits largely at the intersection of the early Republic, the American Revolution, maritime history, and the war on the water. Dr. Kylie Hulbert, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're sort of a perfect person to start with here, because I want to talk, before we drill down on the Georgia Navy, which I know that Clay can do for us, I'd like for you to sort of give us in broad strokes the American Revolution on the water. You know, obviously the British Navy is huge, it is powerful, and the American Patriot side is not, but it's more than just that. And I know there's a lot of different ways you could go with this, but I will sort of cede the floor to you to sort of talk to us a little bit about the revolution on the water, what it looked like, what it involved.
So you make some good points to start off with. The British Royal Navy is the most powerful sea force at the time in the 1770s. They have somewhere around 250, 260 ships of the line, and that number is only going to grow during the American Revolution. In 1775, the Patriots have Nothing. I mean, nothing in terms of they don't have their own navy. They do obviously have ships, particularly in New England. New England, obviously, merchant communities, lots of ships, but they're not outfitted for war. So in summer of 1775, the Continental Congress is sitting there. They're like, all right, we're going to have a Continental Army. That's an extension of the militia. So that's okay. That's considered like protecting ourselves. But there's an argument about whether or not they should form a Continental Navy, because there are those delegates who argue, well, forming a Continental Navy would be considered the act of a sovereign nation. And no one has declared independence in 1775. So John Adams spearheads the campaign basically in the Continental Congress to form a Continental Navy. People argue that a Continental Navy is necessary. George Wythe is like, why should America not have a Navy? If England has a Navy, why shouldn't we have a Navy? And so they do ultimately in October of 1775, Congress authorizes purchasing two merchant vessels to be fitted out as warships. But truth be told, as the war goes on, the Continental Navy never really takes off, despite many delegates' arguments that we have the resource, that patriots have the resources, that colonists are capable, which they are, and they have knowledge of sailing the waters. Yes, they do. But the Navy never has more than 60, 65 ships. And even then, they're never on the water at the same time. So you've got the British Army, which has hundreds of ships, and then the Continental Navy, which doesn't. The British Navy has hundreds of ships, and then the Continental Navy does not. Right. So the Continental Navy then is supported by other efforts on the waters, which include state navies, because some of the states look at the Continental Navy and they realize this isn't going to do us any good. This isn't going to help us. We need to outfit our own ships to protect our own coastlines, to protect our own waterways. And then you also have privateer vessels. And so privateers are privately owned vessels that are commissioned either by the Continental Congress or by state governments to outfit for war and to go out and cruise the waters. Now, the thing about privateers, though, is that they're not beholden to bring anything back to the government that outfits them. So they have a commission, they have rules, regulations that they're supposed to operate by. They have to come back to port with their prize and have it adjudicated in a court of admiralty for it to be legal. But anything that comes from that prize goes to the owners, the outfitters, the captain, the crew, the sailors. It doesn't go back to the Continental Congress necessarily. It doesn't go back to the state government. And so that becomes a problem as the war goes on, because some people think, well, if you're sailing for the cause, shouldn't anything that you capture come back to the cause? Right. So you've got these three different groups operating on the waters, the Continental Navy, the state navies, and then privateers.
Yeah. And what I learned in the process of this is that I didn't really understand the concept of privateers, but sort of in a modern context, this is like a freelancer or a contractor, right?
Yes,
a subcontractor.
Yes. It's similar to a contractor. And the thing about privateers is that they were used in wars in the 17th and 18th centuries. So this is not a new practice. It's not something that the colonists have come up with on their own. It's something that they're familiar with, that they've used before. And so it makes sense that as they're trying to build their own Continental Navy, they would start outfitting privateers, because it's a much faster process. It's a much quicker process. You get them out there, you get them on the water, they start making an impact very quickly. And over the course of the revolution, there are somewhere, estimating maybe at least 2,000 privateer vessels that are commissioned to sail. So that's considering the like 60-ish, 65-ish Continental Navy vessels versus over 2,000 privateer vessels, that's a huge difference.
So while the Continental Navy struggled to become a true fighting force, you have states like Georgia who realize they can't afford to wait, right? If they're going to defend their own coast, they have to build something themselves. So Clay, I turn to you to ask, what was, if any, before we get to the Georgian Navy specifically in the Frederica Naval Action, what was the thought process or what was the thinking in the South about the revolution and the fighting that would occur on the water?
I don't think it was much thinking about it in the very beginning. Speaking of Washington, it was plainly obvious to him when he went to New York to defend it from the British. He had no ships. And the whole entire gigantic, enormous British Navy showed up. And, you know, Washington had his army split out in four or five different places. So even if he had to shift them, there was always these bodies of water that they would have to go across. And Washington didn't have the ships to do that. So, I mean, he was aware. And there was, you know, there was no fighting in the South in the beginning. It started in New England, then it went down into the middle colonies. So nothing had happened in the South. It's only when the British began to turn their attention to the southern colonies in 1778, where naval warfare became very prominent on the southern coast. But it actually had happened before even the British turned their attention to their southern strategy, because we're going to talk about Elbert in a little bit. And that was before the British adopted their southern strategy. So there's some action. I mean, there was always action along down in Florida. Patrick Tonyan, the governor down there, had a brown water fleet, and there was always action along the coast down there with that brown water fleet. Samuel Elbert had to deal with that when he invaded Florida for the second time in 1777. So there's always little action, right? But there's nothing big. Nothing big at all. In fact, the biggest naval battle, Kyle, you can check with me on this, but it's the Battle of the Chesapeake in the South, correct? That's the biggest one that happened in the South. That set up Yorktown in 1781.
Not only does Washington not really have much of a navy to fight back with, right? But the navy he does have, like you're talking about schooners versus the British Navy, which is these massive ships with multiple, you know, masts and sails. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, it's like David and Goliath, right?
Go ahead.
I am reminded, David and Goliath, of this. When Howe pulled out of New York and began his campaign to take Philadelphia, he left Washington
up
there.
Is that General Robert Howe that you're speaking of?
No, it was William Howe, the British general. William Howe. And when he pulled out with his ships, his big giant navy, when they pulled out of New York Harbor to go and begin the Philadelphia campaign, you know, Washington was stuck up there without a navy. And Howe's plan was to go down and get into Chesapeake Bay and come up. And Washington couldn't do a thing. He had to run his army down there to try to get in front of Philadelphia to stop Howe. But he had kept getting reports from different people. He had no ships. There were no ships. He was just as vulnerable in that, the beginning of that campaign, as he was up in New York. So I don't even think any privateers were involved in any of that, you know. So he was helpless.
Yeah. So, no, privateers aren't, I mean, privateers are motivated by profit for the most part. I mean, yes, some of them are patriots and are there for the cause, but if there's no chance of profit involved, right, then they're not going to support Washington. And to your point, Andrew, you know, a first rate ship of the line in the British Navy is going to have 100 guns with over 3 gun decks, 800 men on board. A third rate ship of the line, which is what most of them were, has 74 guns. And then, as you mentioned, for the Continental Navy, I mean, they are outfitting these merchant vessels for war, but they're frigates, right? Or like they're schooners or they're sloops, they're smaller vessels. They're armed with guns, but they're not three decks with 100 guns. Right. So the odds of a Continental naval vessel or even a privateer vessel like purposefully engaging with a British ship of the line from the Royal Navy, they don't tend to do that unless they're forced to.
You know, Clay, I'll turn to you on this. Georgia finally gets their act together and decides we're going to need something on the water here. If you can walk us through sort of in layman's terms, sort of walk us through the Fredericton naval action. Now that we have this as context, you know, how these rogue alleys came about, the process of them, all of that.
All right. Well, let's begin here. The birth of Georgia's Navy took place on July the 10th, 1775, when they the Patriots in Georgia procured a merchant vessel in Savannah and outfitted it and put a swivel gun on the front and called it the Liberty. And on that ship was Joseph Habersham and Oliver Bowen. And Oliver Bowen is going to go on to be the Commodore of the Georgia Navy. And they had heard about a British supply ship off of Tybee called the Philippi. And it had all kinds of ammunition and guns and flints, all that stuff, powder, 13,000 pounds of powder on it. And they went out down the Savannah, got out around Tybee and outmaneuvered the Philippi and had the Philippi surrender and took all of that ammunition. It is said that a lot of that was sent up to the Continental Army up north. That event is the beginning of the Georgia Navy. And it shined light on Oliver Bowen and Joseph Habersham and Samuel Elbert too, who we're talking about. And he was involved in the planning of it. Not long after that, the Continental Congress authorized the creation of galleys for Georgia to be Georgia's Navy. So these are row galleys. They're propelled by rowing. You know, people have to row them. And some of them would have a few sails, little triangular sails. But those galleys are in water, inland thing. You can't take them out in the ocean. So they go along the inland coast and estuaries. That's where they're good. And so Congress authorized four of them. And they were all named after, well, except for one, but the rest of them were named after famous people in the Revolution at the time. One was called the Washington, and one was called the Lee, and one was called the Bullock. That's after Archibald Bullock, who was Georgia's first president, i.e. governor. And the other one was called the Congress. So we had those four galleys.
The American Revolution had its fair share of battles on the water that became landmark victories. You have the Battle of Valcour Island, you have Flamborough Head, you have the raid on Nassau. But in the South, Georgia had its own offering on the water, and it came in the form of the Georgia Navy. When we think of the Navy, especially in this era, we think of the big mast, big guns, big frigate type vessels. The Georgia Navy was very much not that. The vessels commissioned for Georgia were a lot smaller, and they were designed for navigating the shoals and the shallow waters of coastal Georgia at that time. The vessels were known as row galleys. They were designed to sort of have like a flat bottom and relied heavily on oars, which meant they needed manpower.
Are we talking about like a glorified dinghy? is it that small or just sort of like, what are we talking about in terms of size?
They could hold about 40 or 50 people on them. Is that right, Kylie?
I'd say that's, I mean, it kind of depended
yeah.
on how yeah. you were, what you were using and what you were retrofitting or outfitting and
sure.
converting.
They would have a couple of cannon on them, you know.
Sure.
I had read somewhere that they had some 10 pounders on some of those galleys and maybe some 6 pounders. And I read also that they put them on some kind of rail. So can you imagine on something so small and fragile, the recoil that those cannons would call, it'd flop the galleys over.
Yeah.
Right. So they had that, and they had these little swivel guns that were shot smaller things, kind of like, you know, imagine like a big shotgun with grape shot. Right. So they had the swivel guns. So they could hold 40 or 50 men, and then so they were armed. But the way that they were used, Samuel Elbert came up with this neat plan, and it was kind of handed to him. He was on his way to invade Florida for the second time. And this is all under the command of Robert Howe. And everybody, this army that Howe was supposed to put together, was supposed to meet at Fort Howe on the Altamaha River. And so Elbert got his Continental battalions up there. And while they were waiting for everybody to come so they could go invade Florida, he got word of these British ships down around Frederica Island, St. Simon's Island in the Frederica River. It was squally weather, and the squally weather had kind of drove them in there. They'd been hanging out down there about 3 or 4 weeks. And so Elbert's up at Fort Howe, and he hears about this. And he comes up with this plan to go and knock out those ships. And he coordinates the galleys with the plan. So he left most of his men up at Fort Howe, but he took with him 350 to go down to the mouth of the Altamaha and to load up on those galleys and to get into the Frederica River and catch those British ships. Now, Elbert is not a naval guy. He's an army commander. But this event that we're fixing to talk about is his greatest moment as a commander. So Oliver Bowen was there, the head of the Navy, and Elbert came up with this plan. And so on April the 18th, he dropped off a lot of his soldiers, most of the 350 on St. Simon's Island. And the rest of them were on those three galleys. And late on the 18th of April, the row galleys came around a little bend in the river, and lo and behold, there were the British in the river with watering brig was there, but there was a ship called the Hinchinbrook, one called the Rebecca, and the command ship, the Galatia, was way off to the back. And rather than engage these galleys toward night, dusk, the British dropped back and put space between them. So that was on the 18th. But on the morning of the 19th, Elbert went after them. And unfortunately for the British commanders and those ships, the weather was not in their favor. The galleys had the rows. They had people rowing the galleys. They didn't even need the sails. And the tide was going out, and the wind was just right for those three galleys to, you know, move in on the British. But the British were kind of like sitting ducks on the 19th when all of this unfolded. And those men that Elbert had dropped off on St. Simon's Island, they began to pummel those British ships from the island. They had a few cannon, but they had small arms fire too, and they were just letting them have it.
And this, I think, is really the turning point, right, of this entire story.
Colonel Elbert and his troops are just bombarding the British. Literally, the British are just like sitting ducks in the water.
The only choice that they had was to go down the river and get out of the situation. But even then, the winds were not favorable. It was favorable to the Americans, but it was not favorable to the British. Trying to get out, that's how they got stuck in the mud. When they got stuck in the mud, the little tide current made the ships go back a little bit. So the cannon were just totally ineffective.
With their ships now stuck, no wind, and the constant assault from the Lee, the Washington, and the Bullock, the British naval officers are staring down a difficult choice.
At this point, the British have two options. They can either surrender and almost certainly end up as prisoners, or they can abandon ship. And some of them choose that second option. And so some of them make a run for it, and they manage to get all the way back to the Galatia, which is one of their ships stationed near Jekyll Island.
The thing that strikes me about this particular story, and I'll toss this to you, Kylie, is like, this was a circumstance where, you know, we've already used the David and Goliath analogy, but I'll use it again. But everything went right for the Georgian Navy, where everything went wrong for the British.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also a matter of knowledge, like local waterways, the fact like, you know how the tide works, you know how the coastal waterways work, you understand where the shoals are. And this happens not only in like the inner waterways of Georgia, but also up and down the coast. So Clay had mentioned earlier, like the Chesapeake Bay and the Delaware River. And so the Chesapeake Bay becomes really important too, because you need a local pilot. You need a colonist who has the knowledge of where are the shoals, where might you run aground, where might you have some problems.
You need a fixer.
Yeah, like what is the weather typically like this time of year? And like, you know, if hurricane season is blowing in August and September, right, in the South, like how might that impact the waters? How might that impact shifting sands? So some of it is luck. I think the weather, I mean, Washington is notoriously lucky with the weather at, in New York, and then again at Yorktown. So I think the weather plays a role, but I think local knowledge also plays a role. And this fact that the Patriots, you know, are just looking for the opportunity, as Clay mentioned, right? Like Albert hears about these British vessels and he's like, I'm going to take that opportunity, right? So they're not necessarily always going out actively. And that is sometimes a problem for the Continental Navy, that members of Congress get frustrated with them, that they're not actively doing more. But at least on the coastline and in the coastal waterways, these Patriots are like, hey, there's a chance. We're going to take it. We're not going to go like, you know, completely crazy and risk losing what we have. But if there's an opportunity, we're going to try to seize it.
Do we know exactly what became of those captured ships?
Those two ships went to Savannah. That's the Hinchinbrook and the Rebecca and the Watering Brig. And they went to Savannah. And for a small time, they were incorporated in the Georgia Navy. A very small time. But that was the greatest moment of the Georgia Navy, that story right there, the action on the Frederica River.
One of the other major ripple effects of this entire operation is the legacy of Colonel Samuel Albert.
This is the first victory for Georgia in the American Revolution right there on the Frederica River. And it was all because of Albert. I mean, he's the one that made the plan. Nobody over him was messing him up. He showed right there, if he was left to his own resources and abilities, he would have been an excellent commander on the battlefield. That's Georgia's first big victory. It created morale. Boom.
The victory itself mattered for Georgia, but I think for Samuel Albert, it really becomes the defining moment of his military career. Clay, you've literally written the book on him, so help us understand what Frederica did for his reputation, both during the Revolution and afterward.
Well, for the first thing, this was the first victory of Georgia in the Revolution, and Albert was attached to it. Everything before, the British had not yet invaded Georgia, so the Georgians were dealing with Native American attacks and Loyalist attacks, a lot of that stemming out of Florida, but there had not been any British invasion of Georgia. So Albert won the greatest victory of Georgia up until that point. And then after that, there was going to be another one at Kettle Creek in 1779. Albert didn't have anything to do with that, but then after that, everything is downhill. It's all downhill. When the British took Savannah, the Georgians entered the darkest time in their lives, and it stayed dark for 3 years. It was during that time that Samuel Albert was captured at one of the battles, the Battle of Brow Creek, and he became a prisoner. I can tell you that except the Georgia Navy battle, he fought in two other major battles. Both of them lasted 5 minutes, and the Georgians lost both of them. And he was not the commander in either one of them. So when he took the initiative on his own, he did well with the Georgia Navy. But then he was under others. Robert Howe would be one. And Albert could not perform well. So, his legacy, he comes out of that war as a brigadier general of the militia and the brigadier general in the Continental Army. He's breveted after the war, but I mean, he's a two-time brigadier general for both things. And he rides the crest wave of popularity, even though he was associated with the loss of Savannah because his men were there. You know, the person who took the brunt of it was Robert Howe. Albert had, nothing stuck on him. So in all the bad things around him, people never criticized him. They just, increased his rank and did all of that. When he came out of the American Revolution, he had hero status. That was particularly given to him when he was at Yorktown. When he got paroled, he went up to Yorktown, and General Washington made him the commander of the trenches. You know, there's a lot of trenches up there. And that was his greatest moment too, to meet Washington, because that was the person he most admired. So he was there at Yorktown, and after all that, he came back to Georgia, and he had hero status. Yeah. He had hero status, and that was played into him being appointed by the legislature as governor in 1785.
It's important to note that these ships were built in Georgia by Georgians to defend the Georgia coast. As you can imagine, there's a lot of pride that comes with that.
The British naval efforts were big, hulking ships. They are made for crossing huge oceans. And here you have row galleys designed for fresh water that take all of them out.
The victory for the Patriots and for Georgia came at a time when morale wasn't high. So this was a big win for the South.
And that's what makes this story bigger than just one battle, right? Georgia isn't just defending its coastline. It's proving that even a small state with a small navy can stand up to the most powerful military force in the world, the biggest navy in the world. And Kylie, one of the themes we've come back to throughout this series is that the revolution wasn't actually won all at once, right? It was won through moments like this that sort of build on one another, stacking on top of each other. So where does the Fredericka naval action fit into that larger story?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that in many ways, the American Revolution is kind of like a war of attrition, right? Like Washington learns very early on that the longer he can keep the war going, the better, because it's not, sometimes it's about having a big victory because he needs some of those for like morale. But if you think about like Trenton and Princeton, for example, not a really huge victory, but a huge moral victory, right? Like boost the confidence of his troops. But as the war goes on, both on land and at sea, they celebrate the small victories, right? Yeah. Newspapers are full of every time a privateer takes a ship and brings it into port, it's written up in the newspaper and people are cheering it. And they're so excited because they're like, we've taken a ship from the British. Now, most of the time it's not, you know, a huge ship. It's a merchant vessel, but over time, in terms of actions on the water, that starts to play a role in London. That starts to impact British merchants who see their shipping interrupted, who see insurance rates rising at an alarming rate, who see this war cutting into their profits. And the longer the war goes on, the more money they're losing, and the more they start to question, well, why are we fighting this war in the first place? Like, this isn't a good war for me. This is actually hurting me. So there's pressure that starts mounting, economic pressure, political pressure in London that stems from these smaller victories or these smaller engagements. And I mean, like John Paul Jones is the perfect example. He's a Continental Naval commander. He's on the Bonhomme Richard. They take the Serapis. At the end of the day, John Paul Jones loses his ship, right? He sees it like sink beneath the waves 2 days after the battle ends. But it leads to this story of him claiming, like, I have not yet begun to fight. And that legacy, that legend grows. It brings, again, triumph and celebration in a war that we're not seeing a lot of that. I mean, even Washington, if you think about it, doesn't have a ton of victories. If we're thinking about his, you know, if we're tallying his wins and losses and in his columns.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because where the British are sort of this, you know, behemoth of resources and money and discipline and all of that stuff, the Patriot Navy, regardless whether it's Georgia or wherever, is sort of like this ragtag, like pulling all their friends in, right? Like, obviously the French come in and help, but then, you know, we had the Haitians in Savannah, they came in and helped. And there's all kinds of different, you know, participants in this thing. And it's just sort of like rallying a posse, and it works.
Well, yeah. Well, and it's crazy because they have the manpower, but the manpower is divided. So like, that's part of the reason why some Patriots don't like privateers, because they're like, well, they siphon manpower. John Paul Jones hates them. He says public virtue is not the characteristic of the concerned in privateers. I mean, he can't stand them. He writes letter after letter about how they shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be allowed to commission them, because all they do is they take all the manpower that would be in the Continental Navy. But then at the same time, if you're looking at it, you know, taking the step back, you're like, I get that it hurts the Continental Navy, but privateers are clearly making an impact that the Continental Navy is not. So you're right, Andrew, like you need all these various groups, these various peoples. I mean, the French come in and are operating in the waters off of the colonies in the Atlantic. But then you also have like the Spanish and the Dutch who are engaging the English in European waters, and, you know, and are really like stretching the British Royal Navy, you know, taking their attention in ways that then helps the Patriot effort, that helps the Continental effort, because there are those who say, well, why can't the British Navy just blockade, you know, the coastline? It's like, well, first of all, it's a really long coastline. And second of all, that's not the only place that the British Navy is engaged and where it's necessary and where it's required. So by stretching it, I mean, the revolution really does become this international, this global conflict.
Right.
I mean, they were.
Was there something you wanted to add there?
I was going to just say they were in the Gulf, right, Callie? I mean, yep. They were up around the Mississippi River. Some of the British ships, yes. Some of them were down in the Caribbean on yes. some of the islands down there. So they were spread out down in that direction, plus being spread out in Europe as well.
Yes. Yes, they're everywhere, because that's where their trade is. Also, you've got the British West Indies, so the sugar trade, right? They're interested in protecting that in terms of trade, and so it really off of Gibraltar at one point. So it really is one of those conflicts where, from the American perspective, for a long time we had a kind of like zoomed in. Focus. We really thought it was the 13 colonies going, but as we've broadened our horizons and our understanding and our analysis, as we bring in these other components, we understand, like, actually, you know, this was an international conflict.
The Georgian Navy existed for only a few years, and it never resembled the great fleets of Britain. But in one remarkable moment off the Georgia coast, those small row galleys really accomplished exactly what they had been built to do. They protected Georgia, lifted Patriot morale, and helped launch Samuel Elbert into the history books that we're all reading now. My thanks to Dr. Clay Utz and Dr. Kylie Hulbert for joining us, and thank you for listening. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.